Our reading this morning is by Carmen Bernos de Gastold, who's written a charming little book of prayers that she imagines each of the occupants of the ark may have prayed. And this is Noah's prayer. Lord, what a menagerie. Between your downpour and these animal cries, one cannot hear oneself think. The days are long, Lord. All this water makes my heart sink. When will the ground cease to rock under my feet? The days are long. Master Raven has not come back. Here is your dove. Will she bring us a twig of hope? The days are long, Lord. Guide your ark to safety, some zenith of rest, where we can escape at last from this brute slavery. The days are long, Lord. Lead me until I reach the shore of your covenant. Amen. Noah wanted off that boat. At least that is my take after having spent most of February vacation at home with a six-year-old child. Just one, it's true, a girl, and I love her with all of my heart and soul and mind, and two large dogs and two cats, but still I have no right or reason to complain. Although somewhat weary from the experience, I feel like I can begin at least to imagine what it might have been like for a 600-year-old man, for that is how old they tell us he was, to be in a confined space with his family of 7 and 75,000 houseboat pets, especially if he was trying to get other work done. You may not have been housebound with children this week, but perhaps you've experienced having your own world close in around you to some degree with this month of extraordinary snowfall that we have been having. For some of you, in fact, this month may have been quite isolating. I understand that you have been unable to worship together for 2 weeks. Welcome back. I can imagine that many of you, as different as our experiences may have been over this time, are longing for the accumulated snow to melt and the waters to recede so that we can get back to our ordinary dry land lives. This story of Noah and the ark and the flood is one part of the Christian lectionary reading for this morning, the first Sunday of the liturgical season of Lent. And it seems at first a strange story to hear read at this time of year, but really how timely it has occurred to me in the midst of this winter deluge of record-breaking precipitation that we've been having. But the actual portion of the story that's being read today in some of our neighboring churches is not about the building of the ark or the coming of the flood or even the discovery of dry land, but about what happened next. It is about God establishing a covenant. Now, I've said that I could imagine that Noah wanted desperately to be off of that boat, but I also imagine that he was really ready, hungry, to reap whatever sort of reward might be due him for all of his trouble, for having so obediently followed God's absurd and preposterous instructions, for having sacrificed 6 months of his life that he would never get back. I can imagine that he was dreaming, as was suggested in our reading, of some zenith of rest, some crowning moment of glory, some kind of celestial reward, you know, something really special just for him and all of his trouble. I can imagine that he may have been longing during those 6 months or more, really, for the opportunity to have some quality time alone or some one-on-one time with God, this some kind of pure relationship with this extraordinary deity who chose him from amongst all of the people on the earth, him, Noah, to do his special bidding, who spoke so directly and personally to him and gave him such an important task, such a dangerous and noble mission, such a vital role to play. Surely, Noah must have thought he was going to get something special for this, and probably was deserving of some special holy attention. But then this funny thing happened in the part of the story that is being read elsewhere this morning. God makes a covenant with Noah, but as it turns out, the covenant is not just with Noah. The covenant is going to be, what a rude surprise, with every living creature. There will be no zenith of rest in reward for Noah's obedience. There will be no pure and exclusive opportunity to be in communion with God, for God tells Noah that he has to share this promise with every living thing. The whole noisy, messy, smelly menagerie from which he thought he'd finally disentangled himself. Because you see, the story of Noah and the ark is really a story about making room for the rest of creation. In our holy monologues about God's love and provision, as one commentator put it, not just once, but over and over and over again. It is not just about us anymore, if in fact it ever has been. We have to learn to share God's blessings with everyone and everything that lives and moves and breathes. And that is hard for us, I have observed, maybe not for you, or for me in particular all the time, but for us as humans, it is hard. There is something, it seems to me, ingrained in our humanness that causes us to see ourselves as special, that longs to be seen as special, to be the center of someone's attention, perhaps a parent's attention when we are young, or a lover's or spouse's attention when we are older. It is interesting, though utterly coincidental, that 4 days before the season of Lent started on Wednesday, we had that other holiday, Valentine's Day, with its pervasive focus on romantic love, usually between two partners, the dance of two intimates. I know that you as a congregation are reflecting during this month of February on dance as a metaphor for relationships. And then here on this first Sunday of Lent is this reading about this incredibly inclusive, messy relationship between a man and his wife and their family and their God and all of these living creatures. I'm actually in awe of Mr. and Mrs. Noah's capacity to make room for all those others and all those otherly needs. It is not easy to do. And then it struck me as I thought about dance and this capacity to include that the most common traditional celebratory dance at a Jewish wedding is not the dance between the couple necessarily, but the circle dance, right, known as the chora, danced by the whole community, young and old, dancers and non-dancers alike, where the circle is made wide enough to include all who wish to dance. Perhaps that is a reminder to the blessed couple that there is no pure relationship, that in marriage and in family we are not set apart or isolated from the community, nor were we ever meant to be. Anne Morrow Lindbergh, in her classic Gift from the Sea, which is a book about relationships, including her relationship with her husband, Charles Lindbergh, wrote, "One comes in the end to realize that there is no permanent, pure relationship, and there should not be. It is not even something to be desired. The pure relationship is limited in time and in space. In essence, it implies exclusion. It excludes the rest of life, other relationships, other sides of personality, other responsibilities, other possibilities in the future. It excludes growth. No, we need to make room, make room for our children, for our aging parents, for our needy siblings, our neighbors, our friends. God bless them. Sometimes they feel like intrusions, as we no doubt sometimes feel to them. But there you go. That is the nature of life's circle dance. The pure relationship is not eternal. It has to stretch wider at times to hold more. And that is also true, I think, of our relationship to the holy, to the ultimate, by whatever name we know it. I will be the first to admit, to confess, that even as a minister serving a congregation as a vocation, my most profound experiences of God and communion with God have happened when I am alone, outside, in nature, in silence, away from the noise and the chaos and the activity of family life and ministry. As Joan Chittister, who is a Benedictine nun, has said, who doesn't long, after a long, hard day of meeting people and listening to people and cleaning up after people, how inviting a desert can be? In the desert, surely God would talk directly to us. In the community, God speaks too, but only through others. Ah, yes, people say, I would love to go to a monastery to get away from this mortgage, from this wild child, and this pressure, and this sloppy wife, and this demanding husband, and this corporate rat race, and all these sponging relatives, she says, but hold it. Hold on not so fast. The monastery will not offer an escape from all of this, but it might offer us a model for dealing with it. The most valiant kind of monk, she says, in writing about Benedictine life, is not the solitary, but the one who has learned to live with others in community. Whether by community we mean extended family or a circle of close friends, or a religious congregation like this one, or the communion of all living creatures, that can be both good and hard work. The rule is clear, though, says Chittister, love costs. It costs the daily things, serving the meals, providing the needs, asking for favors nicely, refusing favors gently, but love makes demands. There is a Sufi legend about a man named Abu Yazid who made his periodic journey one day to purchase supplies at the bazaar in the city of Hamadan, which was a distance of several hundred miles. And when he returned, he got to his home and discovered that a colony of ants was inhabiting his cardamom seeds. And so he carefully packed up the seeds again, and he walked back across the desert to the merchant from whom he had bought them. His intent was not to exchange the seeds, however, but to return the ants to their home. Just about as crazy as that Noah. Love costs. It makes demands on us whether we are widening our circles of care and concern and compassion to include these aging parents or in-laws or the needs of our fellow travelers in religious community. It demands even more when we widen our circle to include the ants in our cardamom seeds or the birds of the air or the four-leggeds or finned creatures of land and sea, near and far. And those costs can be quite personal, and they may even require of us that we be changed by and for the sake of community. There's one more story that I'd like to share. This is a story that seemed very fitting for this season, one that comes from the Native American Lenape tradition. It is said that long ago, before humans walked the earth, the weather was always warm and the animals lived in happiness. But then one day, the earth suddenly became cold and white. The animals, seeing snow for the first time, were not afraid, but soon the snow grew deeper and the mouse disappeared. All that could be seen was the tip of his tail, and the other animals began to get worried. Then the rabbit disappeared. All that they could see was the tip of his ears, and by now the animals were really worried. So the animals met together and decided that what was needed was for a messenger to travel up to the home of the Creator and ask that the snow be stopped. And as they met to discuss this, the snow grew deeper and deeper, and the small animals climbed on top of the taller animals so that they would not disappear. And just as the animals were in the state of greatest despair, the rainbow crow, a beautiful creature with rainbow-colored feathers, flew down among them and offered to go on their behalf to the Creator. And so the rainbow crow flew high up into the sky through the snow and the winds beyond the clouds and the moon and the stars. For 3 days the crow flew until at last he arrived at the dwelling place of the Creator. And he asked the Creator to stop the snow. But the Creator replied, "No, I cannot stop the snow. The snow has a spirit of its own. All I can do is give you the gift of fire. Fire will keep you warm and will melt the snow so that your friends will be content and warm until the weather warms again." So the Creator picked up a stick and set it on fire by sticking it into the sun and handed it to the rainbow crow and said, "I will give you this gift once only. Now hurry, fly back to the earth before the fire goes out." And so for 3 days the rainbow crow flew until he at last arrived. But by then his feathers had become blackened with soot. When he returned, his friends were nowhere to be seen. Only the tallest trees, the tops of them, were visible. So Rainbow Crow flew down close to the snow, and around he flew until the fire had melted the snow and his friends appeared once again and were safe. But then he flew to a distant tree and wept, for he realized he was no longer Rainbow Crow. His feathers were gone forever. Love had cost him. But the Creator heard Crow in his despair and came down from the sky. And when he saw Crow, he said, "This is your reward. For man will appear on earth one day, will take the fire and be master of all of you. For being so brave and unselfish, I now give you the gift of freedom. For man will never value your feathers, because your rainbow feathers are now black. But your black feathers will shine and reflect all the colors of the sun, and if you look closely, you will see." Benedictine spirituality is intent, says Joan Chittister, on the distribution of self for the sake of the other. But it is intent as well on the presence of others for my sake as well. In giving, we receive blessings that we may never have imagined, blessings that may not at first seem like blessings at all. Another function of community, writes Joan Chittister, is to enable us to be something greater, to be about something greater than ourselves. That is no small task in a world that tells us constantly that we ourselves are enough to be concerned about, that everything else will take care of itself. But she says that kind of enlightened altruism has not saved us. It has not saved us from the destruction of the ozone layer or the deterioration of our centers, of our cities, or from massive unemployment or war against the innocent on every front. It may be a counter-cultural idea, but Chittister says that community is a life-giving choice if we make it. For Naomi Klein, Canadian journalist and climate change activist, and increasingly for me too, our greatest hope lies in community, in local community. And as she says, a key determinant of how a community survives an extreme weather event, imagine 100 inches of snow if you can over the course of a month, is by its connective tissue, which she describes as the presence of common spaces where neighbors can get to know one another and make sure that elderly people are not forgotten during the crushing heat waves and the storms. Or as another writer has observed, the ingredients of resilience are overlapping social and civic circles filled by people who, by virtue of living in close proximity and sharing common spaces, know and care about each other. The greatest danger in times of stress or threat is isolation, and finding ways to expand public spaces and nurture civic involvement is not, he says, just some woolly-headed liberal project. It is a survival strategy. And so, of course, I'll say in closing that as a parish minister, a minister that serves congregations like ours, these congregations ought to be a key component of that connective tissue, that connective tissue that strengthens communities in the simultaneous and ongoing battles against isolation and despair. If only we can stretch our familial circles to add strength to our congregations, and if only our congregations can stretch their circles to include and to strengthen the communities around them, then our congregations can become the teba, the life-giving vessel that I believe we are meant to be.